This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Palliative care and the hospice movement has grown in this country and worldwide. But how has it affected the end of life for patients and their families? Joining us with some answers is Dr. Judy Setla. She's the Medical Director of Hospice of Central New York. Welcome, Dr. Setla. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let's start by defining what we mean when we say palliative care and hospice care. What are they? What is the mission?
The mission of both hospice and palliative medicine is pretty simple. It's essentially to relieve the suffering that people have with either acute serious illness that may be threatening their life, or for those who are actually at the end of their life.
And is the idea here that it doesn't try to either hasten death or postpone it, but see it as a normal part of the whole life cycle?
That's historically been the hospice philosophy and statement over the last decades. But as I'll mention a little later, there's been some interesting research about hospice and palliative medicine in that it's very clear that it is probably not speeding death along, and in fact, there's a fair amount of research that suggests addition of palliative care to serious illness treatment may actually lengthen life.
So the goal is really to have the best quality of life for patients and their families for as long as life exists.
Absolutely.
And that symptoms, control of pain, whether it be psychological pain or frank physical pain, is a high priority.
That's the key goal. Yes.
So when and how did all this begin?
The model of hospice was conceptualized and started by a woman in Britain by the name of Cicely Saunders. And in World War II, she trained as a nurse but became injured and had to retrain as a social worker. She went out to work as a medical social worker, and she met a Polish refugee, and his name was David Tasma, and he was dying of cancer. And she was appalled at how he was treated at the end of life. He was essentially ignored, put in a corner of the hospital, and his various types of physical pain, psychological pain, were essentially ignored. Cicely Saunders went on to become a physician, ultimately, because she could not get the medical system in Britain to address the pain of dying patients. And she spent the next decades of her life creating the model of interdisciplinary care to address all the types of suffering that humans endure, which is physical pain, emotional pain, spiritual pain, and just, grief and suffering.
So she set up the first actual hospice. When was that?
She set up St. Christopher's Hospice, which is a place. It's a location in London, and that was in the 1960s. And within 3 years, she actually developed a home care program, which is now the key model across the world. And her hospice was unique in that it not only took care of dying patients, but she did rigorous research on opioid medications and began doing teaching of medical students, nurses, social workers, etc.
So then, since that time, the hospice movement and palliative care, or the concept of palliative medicine, has really grown worldwide. Isn't that the case?
It has. It's been adopted much more in Western countries, and frankly, the growth was very slow to start. The concepts moved here to the States, and then some demonstration projects through Medicare showed that it was successful and well-liked by families. And we still continue in hospices across the country to enjoy a 95% plus rating of approval by families after our services are over. So the Medicare benefit was created in the 1980s, but really in the last decade, I'd say there's been a marked increase in the use of services as more people are aging, the baby boomers are entering, and more recognition of the services that are available for people at end of life, and people also wanting to maybe not spend as much time in hospitals, waiting for doctor visits, and being tested in treatment forever.
Especially if they're in a terminal illness situation.
Sure, and The later in illness, as the organs get more damaged, testing and treatment offer less and less to a highly damaged body. And so we are an alternative to returning for what is often less and less effective treatment within the medical system.
So what, if any, differences exist then in this whole concept of hospice versus palliative care?
Well, the original model, as Saunders created it, was really for hospice. When the United States adopted the model and allowed Medicare patients to choose that as part of the Medicare benefit as an alternative, and now most private insurances and Medicaid also offer the benefit, in the U.S., we were, as usual, concerned about the cost of care. And so in the U.S., hospice was restricted to those who had a presumed six-month or less prognosis, meaning that they are expected to live less than 6 months. There is no other country who has that restriction on hospice services, but it exists here in America. For those who have a prognosis greater than 6 months, or who are expected to survive, let's say somebody who has a serious car accident, a young person, and they're quite ill, they're in an ICU for a month, but they are expected to recover, then palliative medicine is the term that is used for those who have an expected prognosis of getting back to living or maybe having years of life left.
And how is that care different or similar to what hospice would offer?
The model is essentially designed to be very similar to hospice. In this country right now, though, palliative care teams are primarily located in hospitals because the hospitals subsidize the work of those teams, which include physicians, nurses, and social workers who have expertise.
But under that circumstance, the idea of a potential return to life or a longer course of life, what makes palliative care different than just standard hospital care?
The palliative care teams in hospitals, or those of us who accept patients at end of life, have the same goals. We're trained the same way. And our focus is relief of suffering. That's our focus. So intense treatment of pain, nausea, vomiting, depression, anxiety, spiritual distress. Those are the things that palliative care and hospice focus on, while the rest of the medical system is looking at traditional treatments for the illnesses or the injuries that people have sustained.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here along with Hospice of Central New York Medical Director Dr. Judy Setla, and we're talking about hospice and palliative care and what it has offered to people and families, patients and families. So very quickly, tell me, what are the services that are available? You mentioned interdisciplinary. Who are members of the team, mm-hmm. hospice or palliative care, and what do they do?
So the model is basically highly, what we call high touch, low tech, and it's mostly people that are helping people work through the issues at hand. So when a person enrolls at hospice, that means that they are enrolled in their home or wherever they live, and a team, which includes an RN, who is the case manager, the go-to person for everything, is kind of the circus leader of the group. There's a social worker. There's a physician like myself available for advice or for visits for symptom management. We have volunteers to help out families with things that need to be done. Home health aides that can come in the home and do the heavy work that's personal care. We have chaplains to provide spiritual counseling if patients or families want them. And after a person passes, hospices across the country provide over a year of grief counseling, if desired, by whoever the patient calls family.
So the families clearly benefit as well as the patient.
Yeah, and
model.
That's right. That was unique to Cicely Saunders' model, was instead of most of the medical system where the patient is the unit of care, in palliative medicine, we view the patient and whoever they consider family to be the unit of care, and we need to make sure that we are addressing the suffering in those people as well.
So how is the decision made to ask for hospice care? I mean, what are the parameters? Who's eligible?
Everybody's eligible, and anyone can actually call a hospice and ask if they can be considered for enrollment, so families can refer themselves. Then the process requires that two physicians, must approve that they appear to have a limited prognosis of 6 months or less.
That's for hospice as opposed to this idea
that's
of palliative
for hospice
care.
As opposed to palliative care. And so we would get permission from the family to get records from their key physicians, and then a hospice physician like me has to review those records, and if both of those look like the person has a limited lifespan, and if they are wishing to kind of forego the vast majority of acute care in hospitals repeatedly going back and forth, then we can enroll them. A lot of our visits are for information. There's no obligation when our team comes out and talks to people to enroll. People can enroll at any time. We often see people enroll after two or three visits, and people are free to leave hospice on any given day, and then they can re-enroll if they wanted.
And how frequently are these visits? Not the information gathering ones, mm-hmm. but once you start basically disseminating care. Is it a daily kind of thing?
So what happens is the RNs begin a weekly nursing visit, working with the primary caregiver who is necessary for a person to have hospice, somebody within the family or a friend in charge of connecting for the most part with hospice. The social workers, chaplains come on appointment basis. Physicians make appointments and come. It's important to realize we don't just move in and take over care. That's not what we're designed to do. And we do also provide such services in nursing homes, and that's what happens with some people who require that care, or Francis House, our close partner in the community who provides a shelter for dying patients.
What challenges or stumbling blocks do you find for people to ask for these services? I mean, are there financial ones that people are in denial, medical doctors not referring, families are resistant? What are the things you find?
A lot of those come into play, especially in Central New York. We have some of the lowest rates of hospice referral in the country right here in Central New York. In terms of a stumbling block for hospice, there's very little because our services are paid for entirely by Medicare. There's not even any copay. Private insurance is pretty much similar with a few variations, so it's usually not cost. Our services are free to eligible patients. But people don't want to admit that they have a limited lifespan. It frightens them to kind of think of this. And we also know that this community in particular has a culture of treating a lot, treating to the very end. And specialists, both in cancer and non-cancer, have a responsibility to consider to think about end-of-life care for not just cancer, but lung patients, emphysema, heart failure, and those with dementia.
And also this whole idea of being able to treat the whole family so everyone comes through that experience,
yes,
in a sense lifted,
yes,
or supported. Well, a lot of it and very important information. Thank you so much for coming in. I think you really shed a tremendous amount of light, and hopefully there will be more utilization. I think maybe as the baby boomers become eligible, perhaps they'll bring some enlightenment to the situation. Thanks so much for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Judy Settler. She's the Medical Director of Hospice of Central New York. I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.